From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Is science the measuring stick for all that's real in the world?
It's not the gauge to measure everything that's real at this very moment in time, most likely, because it never has been before.
Why should we have confidence that astrology might not be worthy of real scientific attention, but Einstein's notion of warping space-time is? On the face of it, they both sound kind of nutty, right?
One of the things that makes people step back from science is they have a perception that scientists think that they know everything, and you, the quote, common man, don't know everything. Scientists are just people trying to figure out the world the way the rest of us are.
So how do you draw the line between science and pseudoscience, or between crackpot science and work that's just ahead of its time? Today we explore the edges of science as we dip into history, from the furor over the first blood transfusions to more recent controversies over quantum physics and the paranormal. But first, the science of murder.
Internal organs appear healthy. No signs of trauma or disease. Heart muscle is free of scarring and necrosis. And there's no evidence of any cardiac event.
Healthy young men like this don't simply drop dead for no reason.
I concur, which is why I am still looking.
CSI and its various TV spin-offs have popularized and even glamorized the people who work in crime labs. But the very idea that lab scientists could have anything to do with catching a killer is a fairly new idea. As science writer Deborah Blum points out, forensic medicine didn't even exist 100 years ago. But in the 1920s, two heroic New Yorkers came along and changed everything, basically inventing the science of forensic medicine. It's a remarkable story, which Blum tells in her book The Poisoner's Handbook. She tells Enstrange Hemps that the story begins in the late 19th century, the golden age of arsenic, when poisoners got away with murder.
They were everywhere. I mean, they used arsenic and red lead to color candy. There was actually one woman in Pennsylvania who gave her ex-boyfriend a wedding cake with poison in the frosting. People thought about it, and they believed in a way that we don't believe today, that you can get away with it.
Well, contrast that history where people were, contrast it with where we are today.
We live in an age in which we take for granted that scientists will partner with the police in solving crimes. We know when there's a crime, there's going to be a forensics person out gathering fibers, analyzing them, fingerprints, blood types, toxicology. We take for granted that that's part of crime scene investigation. Less than 100 years ago, that did not exist.
Oh.
Right?
Well, it's also a time of great political corruption, right?
Yes.
Tammany Hall was in power, and going back to the role police played in trying to catch poisoners, coroners were, many of them, very corrupt.
And if you took New York as an example, Tammany Hall, as you say, was a corrupt and extremely powerful political machine. And the golden rule there was that you got an appointment if you had done Tammany Hall a favor. So I actually went and looked at who were coroners of the time, and they were sign painters and they were funeral home directors. But there were a few doctors, and they were disasters. The chief coroner of New York was a guy named Patrick Reardon, who had lost his practice after he'd killed too many patients and who was such, really, a notorious alcoholic. He had to hire two assistants to hold him upright at crime scenes, right? He could not even stay sober. So you found that the police are saying, do not let the coroner's office near us because they're always screwing up the case.
Well, onto this stage,
yes.
Walk your two heroes, the fathers of forensic toxicology, Charles Norris and Alexander Gettler. Who were they?
They, to me, are especially heroic because they're civil servants, two underpaid scientists working in an underfunded laboratory in the city of New York. Norris was the first trained medical examiner in New York City. He came in 1918, and I've always thought he was perfect for the job because he was you know, old-time East Coast establishment money of the Norrises who founded Norristown, Pennsylvania. And he was absolutely fearless in taking the establishment on. And he hired the first forensic toxicologist in U.S. history to work for an American city. And that was a very different person. It was Alexander Gettler, who was a Hungarian immigrant who has put himself through school as a night ticket taker on a ferry. But shared with Norris this, he was absolutely obsessive. And he believed that chemistry could be used as a tool against crime.
Well, these two together pretty much invented this new science of forensic medicine, forensic toxicology. What was one of their first big breakthrough cases?
One of the most famous cases is a woman and her lover who conspired to kill her husband, and then they had taken out insurance policies on him, and they staged a fake break-in and burglary murder and then filed for double indemnity. And this case, the Snyder Gray case, actually became, you know, the stuff of novel and movie legend. It was the foundation of the novel Double Indemnity. It actually played into James Cain's novel of Lovers and Murder and Betrayal, The Postman Always Rings Twice. But the catch was, when Gettler went and looked at it, he was able to prove that the man was completely unconscious, that they had, in fact, chloroformed him, given him mercury and alcohol, and he was able to track down all the toxicology that had gone into killing this man, and they were able to find where they had purchased it. You know, sensational murder cases like that. I was more drawn to kind of everyday cases that weren't so famous, arsenic murderers I really liked. There was some really fascinating carbon monoxide murders. One of my favorites, I do sound twisted, was one in which a man suffocated his wife, and then they had gas lighting. It's the early 1920s, broke a gas fitting, and the gas floods into this little poor tenement building. He's pretending it's an accidental death. Again, he'd taken out an insurance policy. Gettler walks into the room. He looks at the body. The body is pale. And if you know carbon monoxide, you know that a person who dies of carbon monoxide poisoning is not pale. They're going to be flushed pink. There's a chemical reaction in your blood that will make you flush, your skin flushes pink. He takes one look at this pale corpse and goes, no, this is not a carbon monoxide death. And when they go back to the morgue and look at her blood, they find instead another gas, carbon dioxide, in her blood. And that tells you that it's suffocation.
So what's the story of the science? Because there are wonderful dramatic stories about the poisoners, but for Alexander Gettler to get to the point that he can break down arsenic, tell you what kind it was, find it in a body, and then find additional chemical fingerprints,
right,
essentially. What were the scientific advances that he made?
You know, I should say that I really love the chemistry of the 1920s. It's what we think of now as wet chemistry. Back then, they literally were sloshing around in body tissue to figure this out. Gettler was the first person in the world to figure out how to tell if someone was drunk at time of death. I mean, he did phenomenal work looking at alcohol poisoning, for instance. And to get to the point where he developed a test where you could say this person in an auto accident was drunk when they died, it took him 6,000 brains.
6,000 brains?
6,000 human brains before he could work out that chemistry. What's the background chemistry of a normal brain? When he would run people through a test to see if they could stand up to the rigors of working in this New York chemistry lab, he kept a bucket of brains in the lab refrigerator. This kind of sloshy,
like Dr. Frankenstein,
icky.
A bucket of brains?
A bucket of brains. And one of the things that you had to do in the initial test to see if you were fit for the lab was go in, get both your hands in this bucket of brains, squash out some material, and take it over and run some tests over it. So you had to be pretty tough about this.
So let's bring this back up to the present. In our high-tech world today of gas chromatography and nanoparticles, is it still possible to poison somebody and get away with it?
Yes. It's much harder, I should say that first. And the majority of poisoners are caught today. Can you get away with it if you have a sloppy doctor, if they don't do the right tox screen? Yeah, you can.
So that's human error, but I guess what I'm asking is whether we've completed the science. Have we figured it all out?
No.
We can find any chemical in anybody's body and we know what the toxic chemicals are.
No. Do we understand every chemical going? Do we know the toxicology of every chemical compound out there? We don't. I mean, one of the things that is comparable in the 1920s to today is they were awash in a sea of industrial chemicals. We have that same kind of, do we understand everything going on today? I mean, if you look at, say, the toxic database of the EPA versus every chemical they've put through a rigorous test, we haven't done all of them. We're still sort of feeling our way around it. And it enables people not so much to go out and kill people, because most toxic compounds have at least some poison that we know something about. It's that it enables people to misrepresent and scare us about chemicals that aren't really that scary.
For instance, didn't Dr. Mehmet Oz say recently something about arsenic and apple juice?
Yes, and it made me personally crazy because I'm a woman who obsesses about arsenic, right? So he did a crusade against arsenic levels in apple juice. It's not fresh apple juice. It's, you know, apple juice from concentrate. Now, arsenic's a naturally occurring element. So we have some minimal level of arsenic exposure all the time. So you get organic arsenic, inorganic arsenic. We metabolize organic arsenic really well. We're exposed to it all the time. It's in shellfish. It's in seaweed. We eat it. It goes through us. We're done with it. But we don't metabolize inorganic arsenic very well at all. And that is, in fact, the homicidal version. And what he did is he did a test and says, what's the total arsenic? And he didn't factor out or even separate out the organic. So you could have an apple juice sample that was really high, but it could be all organic. And you could have an apple juice sample that was really low, that was primarily inorganic and was much more dangerous. And so he takes something that is not particularly dangerous and freaks people out about it and adds to our general perception that, you know, that all chemicals are dangerous, that everything is full of toxic chemicals. The bottom line is we live in a chemical world. We're made of chemicals ourselves. We drink and eat and inhale chemicals every day. Air is chemical, in fact. And almost none of those things kill us, right?
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Deborah Blum talking with Anne Strainchamps. Her book is The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. Coming up, a story of mind reading, the CIA, and the rediscovery of quantum physics. And Jim Fleming, it's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
Today, quantum computing and quantum encryption bring in billions of dollars in research money. A few decades ago, physicists had largely abandoned these outer reaches of quantum mechanics. Money for physics dried up after the boom years of science funding at the beginning of the Cold War. Then a strange thing happened. A few maverick physicists got together in Berkeley and revived quantum mechanics. And since this were the early 70s, the heyday of the counterculture, they came up with some far-out ideas, like connecting quantum physics and Eastern mysticism. A few even managed to get CIA funding for research on ESP. Science historian David Kaiser tells their story in a book called How the Hippies Saved Physics. He tells Steve Paulson that these were some of the most brilliant young physicists of their day.
And they realized they weren't just out of work or underemployed. They had really deep-seated, burning, you know, passionate questions about physics, about the most fundamental questions in physics.
And a lot of these questions had to do with quantum physics in particular.
Especially quantum physics, some with Einstein's relativity. But you're right, a lot of it had to do with these, you know, sort of famous mysteries that had not been solved then arguably not really solved now.
So there was a real philosophical bent to this. I mean, this was sort of getting away from the, I don't know, maybe more nuts and bolts side of physics and asking the big questions, really, about what makes our universe tick.
Absolutely. And the group that became, they formed this group called the Fundamental Physics Group. And so that's what really drew them together. Just as you say, these are the deepest mysteries about the quantum world.
Now, partly what's fascinating about this story is actually the people who really founded modern physics, going back to the 1920s and 30s, these were the giants, especially the people who created quantum mechanics. Einstein, Niels Bohr, Schrodinger, Heisenberg, Pauli, they were all philosophical. I mean, some of them had kind of a mystical bent too.
They did.
And then something happened and that all seemed to go away.
That's right. I'm not sure it went away. It got shunted aside. You're right. Those deep philosophical, often kind of Eastern mystical tainted questions, that literally kept that first generation up at night. And they would argue, they would cry, they'd call each other names. And this is deeply passionate stuff in the 20s into the 1930s. And then sort of what it meant to be a physicist went through a very significant change, especially in the United States, but even in other parts of the world, during and after World War II, where the catchphrase, the sort of joking catchphrase became shut up and calculate, right? Our job here is not to, you know, worry about whether Hindu scriptures elucidate the meaning of, you know, electron.
So to skip back to the 1970s, when these young, as you say, hippie physicists kind of took up the mantle again, what were some of the more philosophical questions that attracted them?
You know, there were many on the plate, but one topic more than any really captured them, and that was something known as Bell's theorem. It was named for an Irish physicist, John Bell, who had thought very deeply, very philosophically about the meaning of quantum theory, what it might imply about ultimate reality, and had learned as a kind of professional survival move to just keep it to himself. He literally said he had just had to, you know, make sure his colleagues didn't find out about that. He'd do it at the night, you know, at nighttime and so on.
And the radical idea here was this notion of quantum entanglement, that certain particles that had been connected could then sort of end up on opposite sides of the universe and still have some connection. And this seemed to defy the laws of causality.
Exactly right. And so the idea had been kicking around in some loose form right back to the golden era. Einstein and Bohr had debated something very close to that, and Schrodinger too. Schrodinger, in fact, coined the term entanglement.
And Einstein hated it.
He called this
spooky action at a distance.
That's right. He huffed this. If that's what quantum theory predicts, then so much the worse for quantum theory. Exactly. He was not pleased by that. And so John Bell came to this more or less on his own as a young student, read some of the older accounts by people like Einstein and Bohr, and realized that the question really hadn't been solved. And his amazing triumph in a very short article, was published as, I think, only 5 pages, I mean, it's not a long treatise, was to prove, to really mathematically demonstrate that, like it or not, quantum theory requires these kinds of long-distance instantaneous effects.
So when did John Bell publish this original paper that proved Bell's theorem?
It came out in a very obscure little physics journal in 1964 and then, you know, disappeared. It was an unknown journal. It was a topic that was still not attracting much interest. It vanished.
Again, this is so fascinating because, I mean, this is a radical idea. This challenges everything that we know about causality, one of the fundamental ideas in how the world works. And no one picked up on it until some of these young renegade physicists did. What, 10 years later or so?
That's right. So one thing that really fascinates me is this is an article, Bell's article from 64. Today, it's on sort of all of our lips, right? By any way you want to slice or dice it, this is one of the most influential articles of the 20th century, arguably of any time, of any period in the history of physics since the Earth has cooled. I mean, that's the kind of stakes. And so how can we square that with this unrelenting obscurity that greeted the article, as you say, for its first 10 or even 15 years? What captured me was that this weird group, this eccentric and colorful group, the Fundamental Physics Group based in Berkeley, they dominated worldwide publications on this topic starting in the mid-1970s when they first came together as a group.
And they wanted to prove it. At least some people did, right? Experimentally. I mean, so to take it just out of the realm of theory and experimentally show that this was real.
That's right. In fact, the very first laboratory test of Bell's theorem over this quantum entanglement was performed by a kind of founding core member of this group. His name is John Clauser, a magnificent physicist. He also had kind of caught the bug of this philosophical or foundational questions in grad school, was told in no uncertain terms, you know, that you'll ruin your career, kid. put it aside. He grudgingly did a different dissertation topic. And then, you know, the bottom fell out. He barely got a postdoc despite his, you know, very strong credentials. And then he convinced his postdoc supervisor to let him basically, quote unquote, waste half his time by trying to mount a genuine laboratory test of entanglement because the question just wouldn't leave him alone. He said he got very good at dumpster diving. It was basically a zero-cost experiment practically, yeah. Duct taped together. And believe it or not, with the help of one grad student, they mounted a real experimental test. And they found the predictions of quantum theory spot on.
And then there was another idea that still is hot today, but it's that there was some connection between quantum physics and human consciousness. And that seemed to be the thing that really got people going.
That's right. And again, the group in Berkeley didn't invent that, but they kind of resuscitated it. They saw that as an incredibly deep foundational question. The role of the observer had obsessed Heisenberg and Bohr back in the 20s and 30s. And so,
and just to put it in perspective, mm-hmm. I mean, the reason why this is such a radical idea is it's the idea that the way we think helps to create material reality.
The questions we ask of the world change the state of the world, at least in the way these folks saw it.
And then the story gets stranger. And again, mm-hmm. this was the 70s. So, you know, the height of the counterculture movement, the beginnings of the human potential movement, a lot of interest in psychic phenomena. Uri Geller, the Israeli who sort of made his name apparently bending spoons but with his mind, mm-hmm. you know, without actually touching them, there was this thought that somehow quantum physics would help explain the paranormal.
That's right. And so world headquarters, or at least nationwide headquarters for that blossoming, was the Bay Area. And so, for example, when Geller first came to the United States, he was whisked off to the Stanford Research Institute, a sort of spin-off defense contractor, high Cold War, you know, defense contracting site. And he was subjected to careful, controlled laboratory experimentation, right, for mind reading, for telepathy, as well as for what was called psychokinetic, bending spoons and things.
And some of these people, I mean, some of these founding members of the fundamental physics group tested Geller, and they said this was legitimate.
Well, they were hired as kind of house theorists. So the folks at SRI included some, again, very smart, extremely well-trained physicists. Some had written textbooks on quantum mechanics. They were no dopes, right? Very serious and very smart.
But there were skeptics, of course. And one of the most famous skeptics was a magician, James Randi, the amazing Randi, mm-hmm. who said, look, I can bend spoons too, just by sleight of hand. Did they disprove Uri Geller?
They think they did. I don't have a dog in this fight. I'll put it that way.
This is still a controversy to this day.
It is. It is. And what amazed me as an historian, if I put my historian hat on for a moment, was a kind of mini Cold War, right, of the kind of claims, counterclaims, bunking, debunking, so to speak.
Now, one of the remarkable pieces of the story is that a lot of the research was actually research specifically into psychic phenomena and maybe this connection to quantum physics was funded by the CIA.
Yeah, we know that now. We know the CIA and actually more importantly, over time, in terms of just dollars spent, the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency, the sort of internal DIA, between them, they spent something like $25 million on an active research program, a military program in, we might call it, offensive mind reading or defensive mind reading.
And the reason for this was that the Soviets had already been doing it, and they were worried that the Soviets were going to beat them to the punch.
Look, it's the Cold War. How do you get money out of the government, especially the military? The Ruskies are doing it more of and better. What we do know is that it was funded handsomely, continuously for about 20 years. It was supposedly shut down in 1995. The Cold War had ended. And then there have been claims, I can't substantiate, that some of these programs were reactivated after September 11th. So maybe they're still going on now. I certainly don't know.
Now, one of the questions that your book raises is how do we draw the line between legitimate science and pseudoscience? And how do we separate maybe what would seem to be crackpot science from simply science that's ahead of its time?
It's a great question. It's a question that I have real sympathy for, I mean, in my own physics world and let alone as an historian. It's often phrased, how I phrase it in the book as well, is a classic philosophical problem called demarcation. The great philosopher of science Karl Popper raised this in the early and middle decades of the 20th century. There must be some litmus test, Popper hoped. Why should we have confidence that astrology might not be worthy of real scientific attention, but Einstein's notion of warping space-time is? On the face of it, they both sound kind of nutty, right? And so Popper was really hoping to find these kind of golden criteria that he said would demarcate, you know, real science from pretenders, from pseudoscience or fringe. But what I don't think is that there are universal laws we can do it ahead of time. That's my historian's way of saying it's always messy, right? It's something like pornography in the sense that you know it when you see it. And that's not philosophically satisfying. I think it's historically right. I don't want the book to be read as saying anything goes, say whatever you want, it's all real science, man. Right? That's not that's not the message. I mean, it mattered to me deeply that these folks were well-trained, earnest, smart, and motivated by a wide range of things. Do I think any old thing is going to go? I don't think so. But it's a real issue, right, when we think about climate change denial. And it's not just the nature of consciousness and quantum theory. You know, what's real science today is a hot-button issue. It's deeply political. So I don't want to say anything goes. Whoever wants to say they're doing science is doing science. What I don't think we're going to find are these golden, you know, bright lines in the sand.
David Kaiser is a physicist and historian of science at MIT. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, How the Hippies Saved Physics. By the way, this group of maverick physicists not only helped create quantum information science, two of its members also wrote landmark books suggesting a link between physics and spirituality, The Tao of Physics and The Dancing Wu Li Masters.
It came from New York City, man, but he couldn't take the pace. And thought it was like a dog-eat-dog world. And he went to San Francisco, spent a year in outer space with a sweet little San Franciscan girl. I can hear my mother wailing and a whole lot of scraping of chairs. I don't know what it is, but there's definitely something going on.
The question of where to draw the line between science and pseudoscience goes back centuries. One striking example was the early controversy over blood transfusions. In the 17th century, the first transfusions provoked outrage among the leading doctors in France and led to a scandalous murder trial. Science historian Holly Tucker tells the story in her book, Bloodwork.
Blood transfusion was entirely counterintuitive when it was first proposed. And that's what makes it such an interesting story, because for millennia, blood was let. And so the very idea of putting blood into the human body was nearly unthinkable until William Harvey in the 1620s discovered blood circulation.
And that is also counterintuitive to those people, because blood was considered at that time the location of the spirit?
No, it was counterintuitive primarily because blood was considered to be the product of the digestive system and did not circulate. So you ate food, it was concocted, was the word that was used, in the digestive system, moved to the liver, distilled in the liver, and then moved immediately up to the heart, where it was burned off. The heart was something like a chimney or a furnace. And William Harvey, like many men of his time, deeply questioned, to what degree can we be sure that the ancients had it right?
And how did he reach the conclusion that it was circulating?
It's interesting. First, he started with the valves in the veins. If blood does not circulate, if it just moves up to the heart, why do we have all these valves? And he discovered, actually, as he watched, the blood of serpents and the heart starting to beat slowly as the serpent slipped towards death, to see the heart pumping and the valve, the veins and the arteries inflating and not. And he wondered, perhaps something is happening in this hydraulic system. So he then did a dissection of an adult human heart and measured 2 ounces of blood in one chamber of the heart, multiplied that by the number of heartbeats in a given period, and then found that the body would have to make an obscene amount of blood in a short period of time. I think one of the numbers he throws out is 41 pounds in something like an hour or something. And he says there's no way the human body could produce that much blood and burn off that much blood. Mm-hmm. So he puts those together over a long period of questioning and comes up with the theory of circulation.
You know, it's funny listening to you, because you, as you recite this discovery that he made over a long period of time, it sounds so reasonable. And that brings us to the subject of transfusion. The English began transfusion experimentation first, and the French slowly began to try it as well?
Actually, the French engaged in it begrudgingly, because the English and the French were locked in, I guess we would call it in modern terms, a space race. This is when nationalistic agendas are being associated with scientific discovery, so that England and France were not only locked in a war on battlefields, they were also locked in a war for knowledge. So when the English started performing transfusion experiments in animals, word went to France, and King Louis XIV instructed his Royal Society of Sciences to do private, actually secretive, experiments to see if the English actually were onto something. They hoped they weren't because they didn't like circulation, or whether they were liars. And they didn't have much success with those trials.
But that brings us to Monsieur Denis, who took this one step further. Now, where was his experience come from?
So at the same time that the French were having no success privately, secretively in the Academy of Sciences, Jean-Baptiste Denis is in Paris. He's a brand new medical student from Montpellier, not the heart of medical knowledge. Paris has a stranglehold of that power and that knowledge. Denis was trained in Montpellier. He's also a man of lower birth, so he's not part of the elite. And he comes to Paris wanting to make a name for himself. And he hears about the English trials. He senses that there's going to be pushback in Paris. And that's what we do to get people's attention, is to do things that are unacceptable.
The horror of the scientific community must have been enormous.
He wasn't making a lot of friends. We can say that. He first did a transfusion on a young boy who was feverish. He paid the mother to do that, and the experiment was successful in the extent that the boy did not die.
He transfused the boy with animal blood, from a young lamb.
That's exactly right. And the second experiment was with a butcher, a healthy butcher, likely the butcher who had provided the lamb for the transfusion of the young boy. And that also went well.
One of the interesting things about this is the opportunity we need to take to step back and look at the general reaction again at this point, because you're talking about the infusion of animal blood into human beings. And that changes the dynamics of this. This is the middle 1600s that we're talking about,
1667.
And at that time, though we think of that as the beginning of the modern age in many ways, still there was an awful lot of superstition. And that superstition especially dealt with the tales that people were hearing of animal-human hybrids in other parts of the world. And they must have been terrified in some ways.
Well, and to back that up a little bit, we're at that period where the distinction between science and superstition is not yet determined. In fact, the distinction between alchemy and chemistry, astrology and astronomy is not determined. But there's increased emphasis in the works of, for example, the philosopher René Descartes, the man I think, therefore I am. He was adamant that minds and bodies were entirely distinct, so that animal and human bodies were identical in the sense that they functioned as machines, and that the soul, which is the defining aspect of humanity for Descartes, and also the ability to reason and to speak, is that was a disembodied attribute. So that if you were to use animal blood, if you were Cartesian, it would be little more than putting oil in your car.
It would be a mechanical fluid. That's all.
Absolutely.
But to the general public, there must have been some concern, because if you look at Greek mythology, there are all of these beasts with the body of a horse and the torso of a man. There are men with boar's heads. That's a through line in the way people describe horrible creatures, and a source of fear.
Monsters occupied the early mind from antiquity well in through New World travels, and that interest in hybrid species becomes amplified in this time period, because you have travelers going out into the farthest remote areas of the planet, coming back with stories of communities of dog-headed men, of sea monsters. But what's different here, is it possible that science could be engineering those creatures that are at once fascinating and so frightening? And that's where blood transfusion became so abhorred and feared.
We come back again to Jean-Baptiste Denis, who eventually transfused a man who didn't survive.
So Denis' third patient, a mentally ill man, Denis plucks him off the street, infuses him with calf's blood. The first experiment works. The second experiment works in the sense that the man survived. And the third experiment, he's dead. Denis then is accused of murder, which is very interesting. It's one of the first cases of medical malpractice. He ends up doing actually a proactive runaround. He suspects that he's going to be accused of murder, so he goes actually to the criminal courts and says, something's not right here. You need to investigate it. It turns out, after a very long and dramatic court case, the courts determined that Janie was not guilty of murder, but the patient had indeed been killed by arsenic, and that murder was actually precipitated by several physicians whom later Denis calls enemies of the experiment. It's a fascinating case.
It is.
I cannot imagine modern medicine right now at this point without the benefits of blood transfusion, but it was so frightening as to be banned for over 150 years following this court case.
You know, in addition to the question of scientific ethics, which is paramount perhaps in this case, it also raises the question of what exactly is science, because people are both wildly enthusiastic and frightened by science. What's the nature of science? Is that the question that's at the root of all of this?
I think the question is actually even deeper. What does it mean to be human? How intact are those boundaries of humanness? And how does science at once help us understand what it means to be human and also challenge those boundaries? When I take a look at something like blood transfusion and the concerns about science being able, real concerns in the 17th century about science being able to construct these hybrid beasts through transfusion, I think about something like human embryonic stem cell research. At first, they would seem to have nothing in common. But what is the debate around that? It boils down to something quite basic. When does a clump of cells take on human moral status? Right? Where does humanness begin? When does humanness end? And when we're looking at early cultural fears in the 17th century of hybrid beast, we're looking at deep questions about who we are and what it means to be human.
Holly Tucker is a historian of medicine at Vanderbilt University. Her book is called Bloodwork, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution. Can science make sense of the paranormal? Up next, the case for investigating a taboo subject. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Talk long enough about where to draw the line between science and pseudoscience, and you'll eventually bump into questions about the paranormal. Life after death, UFOs, telepathy, that kind of thing. Scientists often bristle at these subjects. But Hollywood certainly doesn't.
There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition.
They're here. I see dead people.
Who are you gonna call? Someone else.
You ain't got a body no more, son. It's all up here now. You want to move something, you got to move it with your mind. You got to focus. You hear what I'm saying?
What I am is telepathic. I can hear people's thoughts.
When I was a little boy, my grandmother and I could hold conversations entirely without ever opening our mouths. She called it shining.
What would you do if they actually landed?
Well, I mean, first contact is a big responsibility, isn't it? They come in peace, we go to pieces. That's not how I roll.
No.
E.T. Home phone.
Our mission is to monitor extraterrestrial activity on Earth. We work in secret. We exist in shadow.
And we dress in black.
This house is bad, Mommy.
Michael, honey.
There's no bad houses. There's just bad people.
It's not the house. It's me. You know, wherever I go, it goes.
No one there!
It's a language, all right. It's English.
What do you mean, English?
That's English in reverse. Listen.
If the human sacrifice is impure, the result may still be attained, but the demon will forever reside in the soul of the victim. She must forever feed on flesh to sustain the demon.
Okay.
She's eating boys.
It doesn't work if you don't believe.
The paranormal is great fodder for movies, but should we take any of it seriously? That's the question journalist Steve Volk explores in his book Fringeology. Volk is a veteran journalist, a longtime staff writer for Philadelphia Magazine, and a contributor to Rolling Stone, The New Republic, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. Steve Paulson wanted to know why he took on this topic.
You know, this is a subject that's usually not good for the reputation of a journalist who writes for mainstream publications. Why did you want to write a book about the paranormal?
I kind of felt compelled. I had no choice. I had grown up as a kid with a family ghost story. And it was something I'd sort of shoved to the back of my mind over the years, but it was always sort of there, kind of gnawing at me that I'm a professional storyteller, and yet telling this story would be verboten, not something I'm supposed to do. And that seemed really curious to me. It seemed to me like the stigma against sharing this sort of story was something that needs to be broken.
Well, you know, I think we actually need a definition here. What do you mean by the word paranormal?
It's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of people take the paranormal to mean supernatural and somehow beyond the reach of science. To me, something paranormal could be a phenomenon that science simply hasn't explained yet.
So the supernatural for you basically refers to God or the devil or spirits or something like that, which almost by definition is beyond the realm of science, whereas the paranormal is something quite different. In fact, it might have nothing to do with religion.
Yeah, exactly. And look, it could be that God will one day be accessible by science, but there's no godometer as of yet, you know. So God could turn out to be a paranormal question rather than a supernatural one. We'll have to see.
And so you're saying that in terms of paranormal phenomena, and by that I assume you're talking about things like telepathy or the question of whether there's life after death, ghosts, that kind of thing.
Right.
You're saying these things can be investigated scientifically.
Right. I have to tell you, one of the things that really shocked me writing Fringeology, I'd gotten so used to over the years hearing that there was no evidence for psychic phenomenon. But in fact, there's treasure troves. There's hundreds of papers, well-researched papers appearing in, you know, peer-reviewed journals by well-qualified researchers that show a very small telepathy that all of us hold.
Give me an example or maybe a couple of examples of these.
Well, it would be a situation like where if you're expecting somebody, if they have four different cards and they're turned face down on the table and they know what the four symbols are and they're supposed to guess which symbol is going to be pulled at any given time, you would expect him to be right one out of every four times by chance. Well, many, many studies on this subject, it turns out people are right, say, 28% of the time, 30% of the time. This may not sound like much, and it could be, you know, within the realm of chance to hit at that high a level, except that they do such a huge number of trials that it virtually eliminates that as a possibility. So the question becomes, what's going on? To me, a truly rational person who comes to this and looks at the evidence would have to say, wow.
And yet I would think the more convincing kind of evidence would be if someone is reputed to have true psychic powers, that person would get the answer right at least 50% of the time, maybe even more if you can sort of have that remote viewing capacity.
There are some examples of people who've been able to score at really high rates. There's a guy named Sean Harabance who I get into in the book. I haven't been able to test him myself, but he has been tested a number of times and he scores at a really remarkable rate of consistency. And even more impressively for his credibility, you've never heard of him. He doesn't go on television. He doesn't do a lot of interviews. He refused once he found out I was a reporter to see me. And it's because he feels that he has a gift and that he sort of demeans it by getting involved with commercializing it. But he does – anybody who wants to test him scientifically, he'll go.
Now, you say covering the paranormal is fair game for a journalist. In fact, it's surprising that more reporters don't cover this subject, that it can be covered like any other subject.
In the journalistic vernacular, this is low-hanging fruit, right? You're talking about life-changing events for the people who believe they've experienced them. And they have, you know, tremendous dramatic scenes in them. For instance, in my chapter on UFOs, I met with a guy named Ricky Sorrells, who claims to have seen a massive craft so big hovering just a few hundred feet above his head that he could not see from one end of it to the other. And it was completely silent. And he stood there for several long minutes looking at it before it shot up and out of sight with a speed he says that there isn't a word for. That's great material to work with as a writer. I mean, I had a gas writing that scene.
Can you do anything more than just trust him? I mean, don't you need some sort of corroboration to give the story legs?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's the Stephenville Lights is what we're talking about here ultimately. And he claimed that several weeks before there was a mass sighting, he had had this solo sighting. And it did correspond with what some police officers in town said they saw. So there were a lot of people reporting the same sort of craft in Stephenville over the same period of time. And the day of the big sighting, the January 8th, 2008 sighting, when dozens of people, I like to say they had the great misfortune of looking up because they had no idea that when they saw something in the sky, they couldn't explain. I mean, look, that's a UFO, right? An unidentified flying object. They're not saying it was an ET spacecraft. But in our culture, we've completely equated the two. To me, there should be no shame in saying you've seen something in the sky that you can't identify. So anyway, to get back to Ricky, what I think gives him some more credence is that all these people saw it on January 8th, and the Mutual UFO Network came in, and they did issue a Freedom of Information Act request on the radar data from that day. And it came back that there was, in fact, an object that had no transponder that was flying very, very slowly at some times and very fast at others, at average speed of less than 50 miles an hour, sometimes accelerating to over 500 miles an hour. Radar scatter couldn't explain this over the course of an hour. There were a few eyewitnesses whose testimony, you know, corresponded exactly to that radar track. That does not mean it was ET. And too often our knee-jerk reaction when we hear a report like this is just to laugh.
You mentioned earlier that what got you into the subject originally was a family ghost story.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I hate telling the story. Well, look, I was about 6 years old when it happened, and I have, you know, this sort of vague fragmentary memories of it. So what I did is I interviewed family members about it. The story they told me is that there was a loud banging or booming sound that would happen only in the middle of the night in our house, late at night when everybody was asleep, would wake everybody up out of bed. And to my sisters on one side of the upstairs, it sounded like it was coming from up in the walls of their room. To my brother and I across on the other side of the house, it sounded like it was hitting on the roof over our heads. My sisters claimed worse things were going on. They claimed that their bed shook in the middle of the night. They claimed they saw a woman walk through the middle of the room and out of a closed door. My parents rejected that side of things, not necessarily that, even that they didn't believe them. As my father put it to me, well, we didn't want to believe them. So they looked into the noise. And what was interesting is that, you know, the first thing I'd leap to, right, is a water hammer or some sort of problem with the plumbing in the walls or the house settling. But we're talking about a sound that would go on for long minutes, tens of minutes, that would go away in the middle of the night and come back. It did not fit with a water hammer, which involves that, you know, that sudden stoppage of water flow. They went upstairs and they tried to recreate it by opening and closing closet doors, banging on different walls. Finally, they thought, well, maybe this really is a ghost. So we were practicing Catholics at the time, and my dad went to the family priest and told him what was going on. And the family priest said, well, usually in cases like this, I'll come over and just do a house blessing. So he came over and he blessed the house. And he threw holy water in all the corners, and I can still remember him coming in. It was a big dramatic deal. When he left, he said, all right, Jerry, that's my dad's name, I'm sure everything will be fine. Only that night, everything wasn't fine. That night, the noise actually got worse. It went on longer and louder than ever before. And we ran downstairs, the kids. We were scared. My parents, of course, were already awake, and they were starting to think about leaving the house for the night. When suddenly the noise did something it had never done before. It hit at a specific point. Like instead of coming from this amorphous place upstairs, it hit at the landing at the top of the stairs, and then it came down one step at a time. My dad describes it as sounding like a child throwing a tantrum, hitting every stair as hard as it could. And then when it got to the bottom, that was it. we never, ever heard it again, whatever it was.
Okay, so it's quite a story.
I'm with you, right? So, yeah, look, what am I supposed to do with that?
What do you make of that?
Well, it makes no sense. It's so remote from my daily experience that I don't really know where to put it. Here's the thing, though. I don't think there is really anywhere to put it at this point. And what I mean by that is the standard skeptical explanation of creaking floorboards and superstition just doesn't apply to this. Hoaxing doesn't apply to this because we were all under observation by each other, you know what I mean, at various times when this was going on. So what was it? We don't know. And that doesn't mean that there are immaterial spirit beings that exist among us. It just means we don't know.
That's a fascinating intellectual stance to take because you're saying that maybe some of these things really do happen, but science can't explain them. So then the conclusion is that perhaps science is not the gauge to measure all of what's real.
I think the one thing we'd say for sure, right? It's not the gauge to measure everything that's real at this very moment in time, most likely, because it never has been before, right? Science is always finding new methods, new means, new technologies, and discovering more and more about the world. Have we reached the pinnacle? Have we reached the end of that? Probably not. And so why not just take the stance that we don't know what this was right now and sort of enjoy that? For me, when I came to the conclusion that on both sides, the people who are so quick to label these things ghosts, you know, deceased spirits from someone who's lived before, and the people who are so quick to label this superstition and evidence of our gullibility are both kidding themselves, right? They're both sort of seeing the world as they expect to see it, seeing the world as they take it to be. The truth is, we don't know.
Steve Volk is a staff writer for Philadelphia Magazine. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, go to our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show, But Is It Science? Number 102B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Brittany Deanda. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you can also download the entire show or the specific interviews within it.
PRI, Public Radio International.